Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Hey, everybody, welcome, and thank you for listening to this episode of Marriage Therapy Radio. My name is Zach Brittle. I'm here with Laura Heck. We're also here together today with Dr. Shannon Curry. Shannon is one of the smartest people I know. As a clinician, she really gets it in the areas of clinical and forensic psychology. I love talking to her and picking her brain. I really thought she was the right person for us to talk to about a question that's been on my mind, which is grief a skill? Can you be good at it? We all understand grief. Grief is a thing that we all have to grapple with from time to time. There's capital G grief, which maybe has to do with the loss of something severe, a parent or a child or a dog or a job. And then there's the more sort of subtle lowercase g grief, which is about maybe the loss of, I don't know, the life that we wanted to live or the marriage we thought we were going to have. Laura and Shannon and I bat this around for a while, and I think it's really valuable. Before we get started, though, I want to remind you once again about the workshop that Laura and I have coming up in the middle of May. I think this is the last week you can register with the early bird discount. Go ahead and visit marriagetherapyradio.com to get more information about that. We would love to have you. In the meantime, this is a very cool conversation. Stick around. Thanks for hanging out with us.
Thanks for having me, guys.
What is a morning look like for you? What have you done already this morning at 9 a.m.? That is a legitimate...
You do not want to know.
No, I'm serious.
What was? Tell me about yesterday. What was yesterday like? It was apparently it was a crazy day for you.
You are a good interviewer.
I know, yeah. Right?
Honestly, because that is a rich question.
Really?
Well,
what happened yesterday?
We're just getting the ball rolling. We can leave out whatever we want, but I am.
Let me think. I'm literally having like my legal team downloaded in my head right now, and I'm thinking, which things can I disclose?
Yeah.
Was it
here?
That juicy?
Yeah.
You had a juicy day?
Yeah, it actually was. Ooh. And I asked Zach if he had a crazy day because I have found, and I don't want to be too woo-woo here.
Oh, I love the woo-woo. Bring it on.
I have found, having a private practice for a long time now, there are these waves, right? You'll almost get, so you guys probably know, sometimes you'll get a bunch of intakes and you almost get the client confused because same demographic, same
totally.
Age, same everything, same presenting problem. Yesterday was one of those days where it wasn't necessarily the clients were all the same. It was just a weird day of foibles, complications, problems, some interpersonal stuff. Zach was saying something about, I was saying he had this very Buddha mind idea of sort of
Laura and I were just talking about that.
Yeah.
Detachment from outcome. Yeah.
And that became the entire theme of the day. It was the theme in my sessions, detachment from outcome. It was the theme in handling the first thing I woke up to. It was the theme in handling the thing that came up at lunch. There was a theme. And I was wondering, did Zach have a weird day? Because sometimes I find other therapists, not only do they understand how there are these waves and client demographics are presenting problems, but I've checked in with other therapists before and they're going through weird periods with clients or they're having complications in their practice. There seems to be trends and it might have to do with more of like macro society, but there seems to be these ripple effects that hit us all around the same time.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, Laura and I talk quite a bit sometimes about how, especially me, I think you do a little bit, like, well, I'll go through phases where I'm talking about the same thing for a week or 10 days with clients.
Zach latches on to lectures and he's like, I got something for you today.
I latch on to like a topic and I'll be like, oh, I'm gonna beat this to death.
Yeah, you are.
Dad used to do that.
You know? Until it gets worked out and it gets on paper and it becomes a chapter in his
worked
book.
Out for me.
Yeah.
Until it gets worked out for me.
Yeah, the clients walk away, they're like, I don't understand why we were talking 100%. About this today. This doesn't make any sense in my life. But Zach felt it was important to talk about.
Yeah.
If it's poignant to Zach, it'll be, I'm a psychologist because my dad did this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He was reading Carl Rogers at the time and he was on a real Carl Rogers kick.
Rogers, he's unconditional positive regard. Is that guy?
Right.
Yeah.
Unconditional positive regard, father of humanistic therapy.
You're so lucky that your dad is unconditional positive regard for you.
Well, I mean, he's
you.
Not.
Yeah.
He was going through a kick. I mean, this was
Let's
lecture topic. This was the lecture topic.
Yeah.
But the timing was amazing. And he said, why don't you study psychology? And I said, okay. Because he was going on this kick and he really was into the book. I mean, talking about it. But I literally asked him a question about how do you choose something and make that your calling, which is a privilege to do anyway. But having this angst-ridden sort of 20-some, I dropped out of Georgetown. I mean, every parent's dream.
Oh, no.
And didn't know what I was going to do. Community college, dropped out of pre-med. But he just, he was on a psychology kick. He started talking about unconditional positive regard and self-actualization. And it just sounded so compelling. I picked psychology.
That's awesome.
Yeah, right on.
So those lecture points that you beat to death, I think they can have benefit.
Yeah. Well, I know how to get my kids to not become a psychologist. And that would be for me to say, how about, why don't you try psychology?
That sounds and they'd like be like, nope. Plan for you.
I'm going to go do
cross that one.
What's the opposite of psychology? I'm going to do that. At least one of them.
What is the opposite?
I don't
What is the opposite of psychology?
It's hiding,
man,
getting away, numbing. I don't know. Psychology.
Math.
Yeah. But the problem is if I say what I think, like popped into my head, I feel like it'll be insulting to the people that I just thought of, but, I don't know. I don't know. Like we have a family motto, which is the world needs ditch diggers too. Like the world needs us all. We need to have psychologists, need to have people who dig ditches. You need to have nurses and porn stars and, you know, everybody else under the sun to kind of make the world go round. So
my husband loved digging growing up.
Yeah.
And he's Australian and he talks about trade schools being so important.
100%.
And how he thinks it's incredible.
I do.
Yeah. You don't feel like a loser your whole life. You feel like there are things you're actually good at that make sense for you.
Well, the other thing about that, that I think is amazing is, you're done.
Right.
You go, you do your job, you dig your ditch and you're like, okay, that ditch is dug. And now I'm going to go,
he loves it.
Now I'm going to go throw the football or I'm going to go watch the thing. Yeah. And I'm not like, I carry around so much.
He says he works to live. He doesn't live to work. We're complete opposites in that regard. And guess who's happier?
Oh, man.
Do you have any athlete in you? Or are you an athlete?
Why are you asking?
I know, I'm really curious.
Well, because Laura and I were just talking about her triathlon training and there's people who train to race and people who race to train.
Yeah.
Kind of like what,
I race
what
your to husband's train.
Yeah.
You know, Laura loves the training. So she picks a race.
Right.
And so I was just wondering if you knew that about yourself as well.
I do actually. So I had to do sports in boarding school. So when you ask that question, it's loaded because we could get into the topic. I appreciate sports. I think they produce character and structure and are really important. But I really thrived the most in independent sports. And if somebody tells me what to do also with a workout, I don't tolerate pain well if it's caused by somebody else, but I can tolerate so much pain if I'm pushing myself to do it. And I ran distances for a long time.
Wow.
And the only reason I could get into running, it was something I discovered in my 20s. I would have never done it as a high school sport because it would have scared me to not have control over it or somebody else telling me how far. But when I was able to progress on my own, I loved it and I got obsessed. But I had to pick a race. I had to have something to kind of shoot for.
Yeah.
Not that I ran fast in the race. I didn't care about a time.
Yeah, you raced.
I just had to have something to look forward to. It's an interesting point.
I don't even know if I have, if I even look forward to the race itself. Like, I don't think I'm really looking forward to the Ironman.
Right.
I just am really loving the
training. You just needed the thing.
Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah.
But why? So, Laura, you can train with somebody else telling you what to do?
It's the accountability piece. So I will fail on myself every single time. So I have people that I will run with. And unless I have a group that's like, we're going to get together and the coach is going to tell us what we're going to do, I will get on the treadmill and I'll be like, oh, that was a good mile. I think I'm done now. So I need somebody else to tell me or hold me accountable. Have you read any of Gretchen Rubin's books? So she wrote, I really enjoy her writing. It's very approachable. She has one called The Four Tendencies, and it talks about the motivation behind people. And I found out through reading that the tendency that I fall into is that I will give up on myself 100% of the time. If I say, hey, Laura, you're going to floss, 90 days in a row, but nobody's
117.
Zach's on 117 of flossing. Very proud of himself.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Well, by the time this episode comes out, I'll probably be like, I don't know. I'm not going to future trip, but I'm Yeah, today's.
So
check me out. Look.
Oh, we got floss.
That's awesome.
And stretchings on there and the meditation.
No, yeah.
Okay.
Anyway,
but I'll give up.
I like that. That's realistic.
It is.
I got 118 days of flossing, but no stretching and no meditation.
I get it.
Anyway,
once you start flossing, it's kind of horrifying to realize you weren't flossing before.
I'm not a flosser. We've already discussed this on the podcast and everybody knows what our personal hygiene habits are. And we're it's not OK either way. Okay, why did we
I'm so sorry. Keep going.
Oh, it's fine. It's just, I like the book because it does describe like, what is your motivation? And for me, it's not letting other people down. If somebody else is waiting or is holding me accountable, then I will show up and I'll do the work, but I will let myself down every day, all the time. So
really,
yeah, it's an interesting
that's
book.
So healthy and pro-social. I mean, to me, that seems like the more balanced way to be that I would expect nice, healthy people to be. I have a guess that Zach is probably more in line with my sort of motivators.
Internally
or
motivated.
Or opposite motivators. Somebody telling you to do something being the opposite of motivating.
Yeah. No, that's true. Like I was thinking about, I hope they don't ask me where I am in this. Cause I'm actually, I think it's different than I've always been. I think for me right now, it's about cracking the code. Like the only reason I would go running is to see like, could it be done or could I replicate
exactly.
X or
that's how I started running.
Yeah.
Can I do this thing that I didn't think I could do?
Or like, if I'm going to play on a team, can I make the team better, but not in the way they think? It's kind of the way that I, kind of the way that I would approach it. And that sometimes is annoying because I'm still running my own agenda, but I need my brain engaged somehow. You know,
I think so. That's what I was hearing there. It's got to be almost like an academic challenge, an experiment.
Yeah, totally.
I get that. So Zach,
you want to have a podcast
or do you just want
to talk about like whatever?
Yeah. Well, we needed to catch up for a second because it's been a bit.
Hey gang, just wanted to give you another reminder about the 7 principles workshop that Laura and I are doing in May. It's coming up on May 12th and 13th. We'd love to have you. It's a great opportunity to revisit the principles and practices of the Gottman body of research. You can do it on a weekend, or Laura has her weekly workshop series that's going to go on. I think they're on Wednesday nights, and we'd love to have you join us. You don't have to take my word for it, though. Just have a listen to what we heard from one of the couples that was with us in our last event.
Hi, how's it going? This is Mike.
Jessica Marshall.
And we attended Zach and Laura's marriage therapy weekend. And I would highly, highly recommend it. Jessica and I had a great time, felt like we reconnected. We've been together for almost 10 years, and I feel like this has kind of brought us back to a honeymoon stage a little bit. Jess, do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, and I think since the workshop and even before that, like we've been listening to the podcast, and since the workshop, we've even just been sharing with our friends and family, you know, different things that we learned from the workshop and some of the things that stood out to us, some of the things that Zach said over the weekend about repair is more important than the resolve, and making sure that when you're in a fight that marriage and your happiness stays at the forefront.
I think our favorite part is I think after that first 3-hour session, Jessica and I actually sat together and we ugly cried with each other. And I think a lot was forgiven from our past and marriage. And I'm just really happy that we had this weekend together where we could share things with each other, find out things about each other we didn't know. And Zach and Laura facilitated a great program. It was fun doing things with the other couples and actually doing workshop type things. And we really appreciate it. And to be honest with you, we talked about doing the same workshop over again just to kind of get closer with each other. So we appreciate it. Thanks, Zach and Laura.
Thank you, Zach and Laura. Thank you so much.
So yeah, we would love to have you. Friday night's a little bit like a date night. It's a lot of fun. We laugh a lot. Saturday, we jump into things a little bit more seriously to help manage some of the more challenging parts of the relationship. But altogether, it's a real benefit. We love you. We love it. You'll love it. Hope you'll join us. The next one is May 12th and 13th. You can register by the end of April to get the early bird discount. Again, we'd love to have you. Yeah, I wanted to talk to you because I've been wanting to talk about this topic for a while. And okay. I knew I needed to have somebody that actually like knew about it beyond the Google. And it's grief. right? And this is coming up in so many places because I think, of course you're going to grieve when your dog dies or your dad dies or you get divorced or you have some kind of pandemic, global pandemic that you're trying to emerge from or whatever. But I also just feel like this is my question. And I told Laura I was going to pop the question on you both at the same time because I really want to start here, which is grief a skill?
I think so.
I'm trending toward this. I'm trending in this direction. Laura, do you know what you think?
Mm-hmm. I do. Yes, I do think it is a skill.
Mm-hmm. Cause I know I'm talking to people all the time about,
so the experience of grief happened, but
right.
You mean sort of managing it?
Well, I don't know. I think what I tried to tell somebody the other day was they were talking about the end of their relationship and kind of the end of the dream that they had. And I was like, yeah, it's a problem. It's, but it's also a skill. Like grief can be a skill. And this is where, like, I think that has to challenge the natural or sort of the typically understood sort of profile of grief, which is it's in stages and those stages are linear and they go like this. And at the end, you'll find acceptance. And I'm like, no, but what if you're really good at bargaining or you're really good at depression? So I don't know. I wanted to plant that seed and then just like talk about it for a while because I think people need permission to think about grief in ways that maybe they haven't yet.
I would love to start by saying that the stages of grief have been completely debunked. So that's a theory. That was a theory.
Was that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross or something?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Okay. And it's lovely. And I think it helps to set a framework for people to understand that grief can look differently.
Agreed.
For different people. Yeah. But I don't think, so what we actually know, what the research has actually shown is that there is not a linear progression, as you said, for most people. Some people may experience certain aspects of grief. Some people may experience a massive loss, death of a spouse, a divorce, and actually not go through what we might define as grief. And that's normal too. So I would say the number one message is that grief can look different for different people. There's no one way to do it. And I really would love for people to not reference a very outdated idea about these stages of grief because it's just not accurate.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, was her theory that you move from one stage to the next in a linear fashion?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
But so what we take from that is it's not a linear fashion, but the different stages of grief, it just opens up the perspective that everyone experiences grief differently and you may evolve into an experience of grief over time that looks different from what you were originally at a month ago, 2 weeks ago, last night, whatever that might be. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Or you may not.
Okay.
But I would say there are some common features. So Zach, you said something really, I think, profound about what your client was saying. And it was incredibly insightful of your client to identify that. A lot of times, depending on what the grief is associated with, a death or the loss of a relationship, there is usually an existential loss. So our dreams died, right? All those dreams I had, all those plans I had, they're gone. Mm-hmm. But then there are other aspects of grief, like just the absolute feeling of a lack of someone, a lack of somebody's spirit, of somebody's energy, and that kind of continued emptiness as you cope with life without someone. And specifically here, I'm thinking more of death and just the bleakness of that. Mm-hmm. When you were saying grief is a skill, I was thinking more in coping and managing, but I would love to hear more of what you mean about that.
Well, I don't know exactly what I mean. What I mean is I think that if we're going to stick to kind of the cliche, which is that grief, ultimately, you know, managing grief is about acceptance. I'm like, I think for me, it's elevating that part of it, even into the other phases. Like I appreciate that I'm bargaining right now. I appreciate that I'm trying anything I can, trying to do anything I can to make myself feel other than this. Like that's still acceptance, you know, or I appreciate that I'm angry. And so I'm going to go hit the pillow or go to a rage room, or I'm going to go sit at a bar and drown my sorrows for a minute. Like, I guess I'm just wondering about, does awareness bring,
that's what I'm hearing,
some level of like, soothing to this thing. And you know, yeah. for me, I've been really fortunate. I do not have a lot of experiences of death in my life. Mm-hmm. Like I just have not lost people. Our mutual friend, Laura, he recently counted up the number of people in his life that had died. I think it was something like 78.
No way.
I mean, just from the beginning, I mean, just mm-hmm. tons
some
of loss in that way.
Lives are just marked by loss.
Yeah. Some, yeah.
yeah.
And
yeah.
so, but I think he has practice in grief. I think he's turned it into a skill, but I have a ton of grief that's not related to loss or death.
Right.
And I think the conversation I'm in most often in my office is, how do I grieve that I thought I was going to get this and I got this instead? And it's very easy to go into a conversation about that being about betrayal. Mm-hmm. Like I thought I was getting the dream husband and I got this other guy instead, but I don't think it's always that or necessarily that.
It's
I think
it's radical acceptance. Yeah. What I'm hearing. Yeah.
Well, yeah. I mean, we build our lives, we sort of speculate out and we go, okay, I think I know how it's going to go. And then it doesn't go that way. And am I allowed to have grief now?
Mm.
Because
yes.
I didn't, nobody and, died.
Right. Yes. I think grief, I think there's grief with any loss. Loss of dreams, loss of plans, loss of something that you were really attached to. But we're talking a lot about this sort of awareness, acceptance, and attachment, which kind of gets into Buddha mind, right? Of when I think about, you were saying grief as a skill. There was a period actually when I lost my dog where I felt like I grieved well, where I was intentional about it.
I
want
to hear about that.
I was intentional about it. I was in so much pain and I was very aware and accepting of whatever was happening. So if I wanted to avoid it, I was at least aware that I had this urge to avoid. And then I would sometimes challenge myself to just sit with it and allow these waves of pain to come over me that often took me over physically. And then we can get into even the science around mm-hmm. tears and crying and how interesting that is, that you have this sort of release of oxytocin but crying actually doesn't serve really any other physiological purpose for, you know, the saline to come out of your eyes. But you have, you know, your cortisol levels go down. You have this physiological release. It's just there's an interesting aspect to this idea of radical acceptance of the pain, tolerating the distress, not resisting it, but also even it's sort of like the idea with meditation, like none of it's wrong. You know, you get a thought in your head, you're trying to clear your head, but then you realize just being aware of that thought and then the layer you add to that of I'm failing at meditation, all of that awareness is all it is. And I think with grief too, being aware of all, it's such a teaching instrument to just notice your resistance, your flailing, the emptiness, the aching, and to go with it, to allow the tears to come over you, the sobbing, your body to literally get arched from the pain sometimes. And then Joanna Cacciatore, a psychologist I really admire, who wrote a book on the topic.
Beautiful name.
I know.
Wow.
I know. And she's a beautiful person, but she lost a daughter and she talks about how she roamed the halls at night like a caged animal because it was such an intolerable loss, intolerable. And she describes grief almost like birthing contractions. And then she talks about expansion between the contractions. So you lean into that pain. If you allow the contraction to take place, it's almost like a whole body seizing. But then you have these expansions after. When I was grieving well with my dog, I would carry that book with me, a bottle of water, a blanket. I'd feel the tears come up. I'd sob and sob. I'd let it happen. And I almost got to the point where I was like, okay, that was only 4 minutes. I can do 4 minutes. And then I'd, you know, fall asleep sitting up with tissues like a baby. And then it would happen again. But each time there was that expansion after, and the expansion got longer and longer in between. And it was probably the most intentional I've ever been about grieving, the most aware. And it also passed that yucky feeling that we normally stifle down and we carry grief in our day to day, but we don't face it.
Yeah.
I didn't have that.
Can we
have that?
Can we talk about that? Because that's the thing when you originally said, like, is it a skill? immediately I thought of the skill of leaning into the hard places. I think that's a skill. Yeah. We are so, so good, especially as Americans, of recognizing that something is painful and then finding a way around it, finding a way to mask it, numb it, avoid it, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And then applauding everyone, you know, good job of like,
you're happy.
Yeah. Oh, way to make that the best of that moment. And so I think grief is a real skill of saying this hurts, it's painful, and this is where I'm supposed to be. And this is how I'm supposed to feel right now. And I'm going to just sit in this moment and acknowledge that this is what's going on. I'm going to accept it and I'm going to feel it. I'm not going to avoid it. Mm-hmm. So all sorts of A words, Zach, if you want to write a chapter on this one, the alliteration is solid. And I completely lost my train of thought. Darn it. I think I keep circling around, like, how do you find a way to tap into feeling the feels and being intentional? And I remember seeing something about like a grieving specialist or a grief group where literally all you do is you come into the room and someone's there to hold you and you're sobbing. Mm-hmm. Oh, I was listening to you talk about birthing, and it really made me think about the whole process when I was giving birth. Was I have to keep myself calm and I have to accept what my body is willing and able to do. And if I get to a place of doubting what my body is capable of doing when I'm birthing, it creates anxiety, and anxiety is actually what's going to prevent that baby from being born. And so I need to keep myself calm.
That's interesting.
And so as you were talking about birthing, I went, this is a perfect, perfect example of grief, in that if you can accept that this is the purpose, you are supposed to be grieving, there is a reason why you're doing it, and you can sit in that pain and discomfort, but also keep yourself calm and keep reminding this is where you're supposed to be, what you're supposed to do. It will allow your body to go through what it's supposed to do, which is birthing a baby or going through the grief that it's supposed to go through.
Dr. Cacciatore tells a story where she takes that to her current life. So she has other kids and she's talking about, they're at an amusement park and she realizes, you know, it's saying you have to be this high to board the ride. And she realizes her daughter would have been that high that year. I think she would have been about six, right? And she talks about how she talks a lot about grief not being something you recover from, but being something you manage. And that goes to, I think, Laura, what you and I were thinking of as the skill of managing it,
right?
Of leaning in, knowing when to lean in, knowing what to expect, and then how to manage it best. Mm-hmm. So she's standing in line and she's got her two kids with her and she starts crying immediately. She steps out of line with them, sits down, and she just lets herself cry. And it's quick. I mean, really, when Gunnar died, I remember, like, I could time it. Just like a contraction, just time it out. Mm-hmm. And I knew I could get through anything for a few minutes.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
So she says, her daughter says to her, like, mommy, do you not want to, you know, do we need to go home? Do we not need to go on the ride? And she actually said to them, no, I do want to go on the ride. I just needed to be sad because I missed your sister. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And now I'm okay. And let's go on the ride.
Yeah.
Okay. My body doesn't like manage it. I don't want to manage it. I want to
get rid of it.
I want to, no, I mean, sort of, but I recently read this article by Amanda Knox. You know who that is? Mm-hmm. Amanda Knox is this gal who, was convicted of murder in Italy, and it was a wrongful conviction. And she spent a bunch of time in jail that, you know, is really problematic. And now she's home, and she wrote this article about that experience, about being in jail and being, you know, kind of, this is her life. She had no real expectation that she was going to get out because she'd been railroaded by the system. Mm. And she said, you know, the way that I came to terms with that was I understood almost immediately, and she calls it an epiphany, that this wasn't me, my life getting taken away from me. This was my life. This wasn't me getting ripped out of my life that I planned. Like, no, this is my life. Here I am. I'm in this jail. This is what I, and so, you know, here's this woman who is grieving like in real time about something that is, you know, really terrible and kind of going, okay, this is what I have to do. And so I don't know if she would call it managing. I don't know if I would call that managing, but I think it's what I'm thinking about when it comes to, is this a skill? Like, is it a, can you learn? Because a skill for me is something you can learn how to do. Something you can learn how to do and something you can learn how to perfect. Can you learn how to say, no, this is my life, which it kind of sounds like.
This is all there is.
Yeah. This is what it is.
This is all there is. Yeah.
This isn't like my life should be this other thing where I have a dog or a daughter. My life should, my life is, this is my life. And I think that when we can do that, there's something about it that feels a little bit less like managing and more like empowerment, I think. And
I think you're right.
This is kind of bringing me into a lot of the grief that my couples are going through with COVID, post-COVID grief. And,
right?
and I won't even say post, because a lot of the folks that are still grieving, it's not post-COVID. It's still, they're still right in the middle of it. But it's going back to what you said at the very beginning, is the detachment from the outcome. The outcome was, I had an idea of what 2021, 2022, 2023, whatever was going to look like. And maybe they're still fighting the idea that that was not what I had expected. That wasn't the job that I thought I was going to have. That's not how my kids were going to go to school. That's
my
not
financial life should have gone like this. My kids' development should have gone like this. Should have gone like totally.
Yeah.
So now I have this question, and Shannon, this is where I think you can actually make me smarter or make us smarter, is okay. Well, what do you do, like, therapeutically, what do you do? This is the part for me, again, the part of the conversation Laura and I are having, because I don't like to stretch and I don't like to lift weights, in part because they both feel like they're just not enough ROI for the moment, right? Like, I don't get to see the muscles right away. I don't get to feel, you know, I understand the importance of the work, but so I have this real strong bias for doing, because I don't want the waiting. So when you think clinically about how to bring or invite or lead people through this, what do you do? What do you bring to the table there?
I love that question. I mean, grief is interesting because it is so motivating in and of itself. Mm-hmm. It's one of the rare human experiences where I don't have to worry that people are going to do their homework or not. It's so fucking miserable. Mm-hmm. If people are really in the thick of it, they will do anything to feel better, anything. And if I can give them the actual tools that will make them feel get better, and I'll tell you what those are, they do it. Mm. So essentially when somebody is going through profound loss and they're crying and they don't feel like themselves and they're having clinical depression symptoms, et cetera, the first thing I tell them is that I want them to cry whenever they have the urge. Mm-hmm. And we talk about what that's going to look like and the barriers to that. Because if you're working a job or if you're just not used to crying, it's really interesting how people say, well, I can't cry. You know, I'll be at the desk and there are people around. We'll change their actual schedules so that they have time to cry. Mm-hmm. And there are some shared experiences. I was just talking with a client, and I've grieved before, and I've also been, you know, through a divorce, and we were talking about even joking how a song will come in a restaurant and you almost can't tolerate it because the tears come up and you're just trying to hang out with your friends and you start crying at lunch. So I make sure my clients and I are prepared for all the potential times that might come up, almost like when you're working through addiction or you're identifying all the vulnerable moments, all the barriers. And what are we going to do when that barrier comes up, that barrier? And we just make exit routes. They go in the bathroom, they cry a little bit, they do their makeup differently so it doesn't drip all over their face and they have to worry about cleaning it up. We really protective factors make it possible to cry. And then I think when they lean into it more, they get more comfortable with it and realize, oh yeah, that wasn't so bad. If I go in the bathroom, cry for, again, 5 minutes, I'm actually good for 2 hours, like actually good. Whereas before that, I would just spend the whole day in a haze. Hmm.
You mentioned about crying earlier, and I just thought that was really interesting because I've never really thought about it. I think about the human body and, you know, how special each part of it is and why we have parts, what they do, the function of it. But did you say that when you cry, it releases oxytocin?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Similar to sex, orgasm.
Yeah.
And then I also was going to say holding a baby, like if you look in your baby's eyes, mom's pupils dilate, baby's pupils dilate, you get this flood of oxytocin. There are so many interesting little physiological things that usually have to do with love, you know, connection, goodness in life. And crying is one of those things that gives us one of those natural oxytocin boosts.
Wow.
Okay, I have the opposite question, which is we're going to make room for all this crying, which is fine. I don't think that would necessarily be my modus operandi when it comes to grief. But what about the rage? What about the wanting to hit things or the wanting to scream or the is it the same? Do we make room for that too? Is that a different strategy?
Well, I'm curious about the rage. So if we're talking about can you give me more of an example?
Well, I don't know. Like my partner just had an affair and I'm really sad about that. And I'm going to cry. Of course I'm going to cry because the song that's going to come on, or I'm going to drive past that bar that they used to go to or something. But what about when I just want to be like, fucking fuck up, bro. When you die, yeah. You know, like, is that, do I need to make room for that too?
Sure. Get you it know? Out. I mean, I remember screaming into a pillow, just screaming because the sobbing didn't feel like enough. It didn't feel like it cleansed out the black tar that was in my gut.
Yeah.
I've done that. I mean, as we're saying that, it's an interesting question because I'm remembering some research on sort of the idea of punching pillows and whatnot. And the findings of the study were that people were actually more agitated after they did that.
Yep.
Had more negative thinking.
It reminds me of George Bach.
Yeah.
Having couples hit each other with these foam bats. And what they found out is like the hitting didn't actually, it wasn't a cathartic experience for them. It actually just caused more stress and irritability. Yeah,
more agitation, more adversarial type feelings.
Yeah.
But I don't know in the context of grief how that would be. That's really interesting because I don't normally get enraged when I'm grieving. So I haven't explored that the same way.
Well, it is one of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's phases, anger. This is what I'm.
That's true.
No, but you know, the whole industry built around like rage rooms, you know,
where
people
can
go in and kind of let it all out. And I sort of feel like I want to prescribe that sometimes, which is like, go put on your hazmat suit and take your baseball bat and go smash a bunch of stuff. I
feel like there's sadness underneath it.
Okay. So that's where I was going with this just for a second, I want you to go back and remember, what was the movie where it was,
I got this. I know what it is.
You have no idea. You have no idea.
I'm going to name the movie though. Go.
Okay. You go.
No, you're going to describe the movie. I'm going to tell you what it is. The movie with the emotions.
It's Good Will Hunting. Okay. There's a therapist. There's a scene, right? And it's Robin Williams and what's his name?
I would have gotten it at therapist and Robin Williams. I would have said Good Will Hunting. Just so you know.
Who's the main character?
It's Matt Damon.
Okay.
His name is Will Hunting.
There we go. Will Hunting. Okay. So where I'm going with this is that often we cannot access sadness, depression. Yeah. We can't go to those emotions without first enacting something bigger. So when you said, I think there's sadness under there, like the rage piece, is that in the movie, there's a moment where he's saying something over and over and over. I can't remember what it is. It's something, you know, like,
it's not your fault.
It's not your fault. It's not your fault. It's not your fault.
Scene.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's so powerful. And what you see is this anger that comes up, but what's underneath all of that. And so it's almost like a releasing,
it's the sobbing,
right? The sobbing that's underneath. So I do think if you're experiencing, if you're going to rage, if you're going to anger, if you're going to whatever that is, unlock it, let it out, just because there's something underneath for you to experience. And we can't often access that sadness until we have been able to unlock the rage first. Some people go to sadness because, like, a skill, it's something that they're good at. They're really accustomed and comfortable, but I think
they know the anger iceberg.
Yep. We sometimes just got to go with what's on top and just let it go. anyway, that's what came up for
until
me.
Until you get to the tears.
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Until the shouting becomes choked up sobbing.
I buy that part. Yeah.
You buy that?
Because, I mean, we've seen this movie every time, which is the, you know, the it's the wife and she's mad at the lover, the male or whatever. And she's like, I hate you. I hate you. I hate you. And she's pounding his chest.
Yes.
And then she like collapses into the, I love you. I love you. And then they're hugging sort of like, that's always the climax mm-hmm. of this sort of mm-hmm. moment. So yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe it's, maybe you do have to kind of respect that, that sadness is mm-hmm. there. The other piece that I would, though, I want a little bit of insight into is we're talking about profound loss quite a bit. And I'm, what do you make of, or how do you direct people around just sort of the more subtle loss, the more subtle grief, or maybe the one that they don't quite, mm-hmm. that they don't get to label with something dramatic, like an affair or a death or a, you know, like it's just more like, this isn't what I signed up for.
That's super dramatic.
Trying to think of an example. I do great when I have an example.
Okay. I'm going to give you an example because I see this, and it's a really tough one. It for mm-hmm. a lot of moms, they have not had the opportunity to grieve the loss of just their independence and being something other than a mom. Because, you know, you become a mom and then you're supposed to be excited about taking care of all these other kids. But there's also this part of you that you're grieving. Zach and I were talking about the evolution of acceptance of your body and what your body means for you. And there is this grief that I don't think we take time to grieve, which is the loss of our body as an independent being that was something other than these, they went from fun bags to milk bags, right? Like there's mm-hmm. this grief that occurs, but it's mm-hmm. more than just what your body represents. It's who you represent to the world and to other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a piece of grief that we never really sit and acknowledge.
The loss of identity totally. Or the grief of even an intentional choice to not have children mm-hmm. and the grief, you know, I think if you, what is the therapy where they're the different selves?
IFS.
What does IFS stand for?
Internal family systems.
Oh, no. I'm thinking.
It's lifespan integration.
Is that
similar?
It?
They're it's all very similar.
It sounds, I think you're trying to describe lifespan integration, but.
Okay.
But yeah, you're sort of making like, peace with your past right. self, a little bit of reparenting.
Like what yeah. would this part of yourself, oh no. This is, I want to say like masks or something, but anyway, that's beside the point. Yeah. But essentially,
we just make stuff up. And so right. see if we can.
We'll get there.
See if somebody will buy it.
One of those things where you have the client talk to the, yeah. the mom and them.
Yeah.
But
or we just assign letters to it. We're just like, it's ABCDEFG. Right. Yeah, do you do that?
Sounds awesome.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I'm totally into MSQ.
So if you're a mom, you would literally imagine what the part of you who's not a mom looks like, dresses like.
Mm.
She's sitting right there on the couch across from you. What does this woman look like? What is she wearing that day? Mm-hmm. What does she want you to know about herself? Or if you've decided not to have children, what is the part of you that wanted to have children look like, dress like, say, and what you usually end up finding is that you've almost put that part of you in a box, like
right.
it becomes black and white, like, oh, I don't want to be that lame mom who just like is wearing a flannel shirt and has, you know, her roots growing out and is sad and passive. But then you actually create that person mm-hmm. and you're supposed to kind of have a mental conversation with them. What do they have to say? And you realize she says something like, I actually like, I matter too. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm not just some pathetic loser. Mm-hmm. I matter too. And I'm sort of, I'm a part of you and don't discard me completely. And it's this weird, I mean, it's going to sound so woo woo, but I think it's this really beautiful integration of yourself rather than just pushing something aside and thinking it's worthless.
Yeah. No, I don't think it sounds woo woo. And I think it speaks to the part that what remains. Like
right
now, all the rage is everything, everywhere, all at once, this movie, you know, and she's got 45 different manifestations of herself. But what remains? What remains is sort of the core, particularly for her husband. It's not a mystery for the husband. What remains for him is kindness. Like, doesn't matter what what outfit I have on or what I say or where I live or what path my life's taking. The core of me is still kindness. And I wonder if grief is something about just making peace with the sort of the core of you, independent of the circumstances around you, whether you're in jail or whether you're a mom or whether you're not a mom or, you know, like those things. I don't know, dude. I really just want to figure out how to
the observer.
Yeah. I don't want people to not suffer, because life is, you know, life invites suffering. It's just kind of the deal. It's part of what happens, but I do want them to, and I want to be able to sort of go, but there's this other thing that remains, which is me. I'm here. This is me. This is my stuff. And this is what I got. And this is what I have to offer. And that's still worthy.
You know, I'm going to share something. I've been thinking a lot about this lately, what you're describing, sort of, if we strip away the ego or the identity or all of these layers, these ways we see ourselves, who are we? What's left? What can we hold on to in times of great suffering? My dad was larger than life. He was chief of staff at Hoag Hospital. He's gregarious, charming, absolutely brilliant, good looking, altruistic, really phenomenal guy. And he has Alzheimer's right now. He just got diagnosed. We were recently on a family trip together, and I was seeing the progression of it, and I cried myself to sleep one night. And that's a form of grief, right? Mm-hmm. So this loss of my dad's identity. And also, while I was crying myself to sleep, I was thinking, this is absolutely not what he would want. You know, he was an arrogant prick, and he was dry and funny. And we would have probably made a joke about how we would make sure that he could off himself before it got to this, you know, if he were in his right mind. And I was thinking, I can't help him do that. The one thing I know he would have wanted. However, over the last month, he and I have been spending a lot of time together. And there's that book, Still Alice, about the woman who had early onset Alzheimer's. Wow. And she was this linguistics professor. She talks about, she feels like she's bottoming out, like everything she worked her entire life for is bottoming out. But kind of at the end of the book, even with all of her faculties compromised, she says, you know, something to her daughter about it being about love, something her daughter is reading to her. She still understands that. What I'm seeing with my dad is, you know, this guy was larger than life. He'd write these freaking manuscripts, and he can hardly find words now. He is the happiest I've ever seen him. That's what I'm realizing. He's way happier these days hanging out with me and my sisters. He can't necessarily share it. He gets confused, but nothing thrills him more than me saying, you know, having him over, him finding out he's going to get to come over to the house. We're going to all have dinner together. That's a lot less. I don't know. All that ego got stripped away. All those things that he identified himself as. In my mind, I was thinking that's the worst thing ever.
Yeah.
Because I think it makes me afraid. And you guys are in the same boat. We've worked so hard. Our cognition is our work, our life. And he's lost that.
Yeah.
But he's still in there. He's still in there. And I don't know. It's really interesting to see somebody's ego get completely stripped away, and the beauty that remains, even when it's what I thought would be the worst thing ever.
Yeah. I definitely, Zach knows this, because we, and even on the podcast, like, we kind of went through this process of the last 3 years. I moved to Bend to be with a parent who has Alzheimer's, who has since passed. So gone through the process of that, and 100% was in that happy phase. And it was the just sort of happy-go-lucky, just present. There was a presence about him, you know, and it just, it was, I 100%, as you're talking about it, I'm thinking about how Gary, my father-in-law, was in that process. And it was kind of like a stripping away of the ego. It was just, you know, being there and like picking your nose and nobody cares. Like, just, you don't, it, like, there's, yeah. So it's, Gosh, man, this is an interesting topic, and I would love to continue to talk about grief, because I've written down a couple of things. Still Alice is a book that you mentioned. Is this a nonfiction? Is it a biography? Yeah.
Well, okay. I have to be honest. I haven't read the book. Yeah. I said book because I know it was a book. Yeah. I've only watched the movie.
Oh, it's a movie.
I love it's that. With Julianne Moore. Oh, she's incredible.
Yeah,
in it.
Yeah.
But I think it's a book.
Okay. Okay. But at least it's a movie if people are interested in watching it.
But Julianne Moore is incredible in it. Alec Baldwin's in it.
Cool.
But Julianne Moore is incredible in it, especially because, you know, she's this Columbia professor and she talks about linguistics and cognition. She knows exactly what's happening. It's devastating. It's your worst nightmare as yeah. somebody who uses their brain as their life's work.
Yeah.
And she talks about that feeling of it just bottoming out. And then in the end, you know, she's hardly verbal and nodding off, but her daughter's reading to her. And at one point she kind of comes to and answers a question for her daughter barely. And, it's still her. Mm-hmm. She understands that it's about love and they kind of heads together. Mm. And it doesn't mean it's not a mess and that Alzheimer's isn't the worst, shittiest thing yeah. in general yeah. and that there's agitation and fear and it's degrading, but she's still her.
Mm-hmm.
When we're talking about what that essence is that makes us us, she's in there.
Oh, it right. is the nastiest, worst thing.
I'm glad we figured it out.
Yeah. Now we've got grief all figured out. We've let our listeners
we
know.
Grief
we've
on this,
solved it.
This half hour.
Yeah. So. With all of our brilliant minds combined, we still are unclear on as to what Nancy Young's study is, her expertise. Okay. Well, I have to land this plane because I have a client in 2 minutes.
Okay.
Thank you so much. This has been awesome. I was telling Zach, I mean, your media kit is like extensive. This is off the record.
Yeah, it's pretty long.
But I would love to talk about narcissism and gaslighting.
Basically, will you come back, Shannon?
Yeah, will you come back?
Yeah, I love hanging out with you guys. And I really do. It's awesome. So fun.
If we want to find you in the meantime, what do we do that? I know we can check out the morning news in the Los Angeles area.
I was
going to
say, text me.
No, I mean,
like if people want to.
Yeah, people want to find you.
We'll give your number on air. They can text you whenever they want. Yeah,
just call her on Sunday night.
They go to the website, currypsychology.com.
Oh, that's easy.
There you go.
currypsychology.com. Love that. Thank you so mm-hmm. much for coming on. We'll have you on again because I have lots
guys.
Of other questions for you.
I would love that.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Marriage Therapy Radio. We always love having Shannon on. This is probably the third or fourth time that we have met with her in various capacities, and she is always a wealth of knowledge. If you want to check out Shannon Curry, go to currypsychology.com. You can just Google her. She's nice to look at as well if you're interested in that. Thanks so much for all of your time and attention, making your relationship better today than it was yesterday.
Seeking the truth never gets old. Introducing June's Journey, the free-to-play mobile game that will immerse you in a thrilling murder mystery. Join June Parker as she uncovers hidden objects and clues to solve her sister's death in a beautifully illustrated world set in the roaring 20s. With new chapters added every week, the excitement never ends. Download June's Journey now on your Android or iOS device, or play on PC through Facebook Games.